If you have your Bibles, you don't have far to turn. We're going to pick up a few verses in Genesis chapter 1, and we're going to read from verse 26 down to the end. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, in our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, and over all the creatures that move along the ground." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and over every living creature that moves on the ground." Then God said, "I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth and every tree that has fruit with seed in it. They will be yours for food. And to all the beasts of the earth and all the birds of the air and all the creatures that move on the ground, everything that has the breath of life in it, I give every green plant for food." And it was so. And God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day, the last day of creation. And the key verse, really, that I want to focus on, or indeed just the first half of that verse, is the last one, verse 31. God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. And this week's sermon really doesn't stand alone, as it were. It's half a sermon. Don't worry, you're not being diddled out of your sermon. It needs next week's sermon to make it whole. Why is that? Well, if you're the sort of person, and there are such people in the world, I know, who turn to the end of the book to check out the ending before they read it. Shame on you, I say. But there are some people like that. If you're that sort of person, then you need to know that next week, Richard Hodges is coming, and he's speaking on what we believe about the fall and about sin, and therefore about the brokenness of the world. And it's worth bearing that in mind in case we get overcome by positivity this morning, or even cheerfulness in our consideration of the beauty of the world. But let's make no bones about it. Life is hard. Life can be hard. We've been thinking about the sadness and sorrow and bereavement of some of the members of this fellowship, and that will be circumstances that are repeated in homes, in churches, in towns, cities, villages, houses all across the world this morning. It's hard to live in the real world, as we might say, and if we are living in the real world, it's hard to imagine another. I think that's particularly true when we live in the city, where we're almost totally surrounded by a constructed environment with tarmac, bricks, steel and concrete, and if you live around here, empty lager cans and the debris of takeaways. These things weigh heavily on our souls and our minds. And of course, Christians believe that the world we live in is profoundly broken. Human wickedness grips every news bulletin. Injustice and unfairness condemn millions to lives of misery. Disease and death threaten to negate life and joy. And our universe, from earthquakes to asteroids, seems coldly indifferent to our suffering and pain. And all that we can look forward to next week when Rich tackles sin and the fall. But that is not the universal truth about the universe. Genesis chapter 1 speaks of a different world in which God creates everything, and everything is good, and the whole thing is very good indeed. And we mustn't forget that. For to do so is to be in great danger of falling into the deepest cynicism about life, about our universe, and indeed about other people. If we believe that our world is a random expression of meaningless processes, and that you and I are the result of meaningless processes, then eventually it will dawn on us that life is very miserable indeed. And that cynicism abounds everywhere in our culture, and it has seeped deeply into popular culture because it's a bittersweet symphony, this life. Try to make ends meet, you're a slave to money, then you die. Any takers? The Verve Yeah, that's a pop song. We didn't write pop songs like that in 1958, did we? Because it's a philosophical wrestling with the emptiness of this life. And we see that everywhere. It haunts our dreams and eats away at what's left of our society's ideals. American democracy, it's all a fix. Another shared value bites the dust. But this morning, I want to stop the clock at Genesis chapter 1, verse 31. God saw it was all very good, the end of the sixth day. And I want to insist that the universe we live in still displays facets of its original glory. John has showed us some. Thankfully, he didn't pick the ones I'm going to show you. Yes, the universe is broken. Yes, like us who are believers, it longs for a better day. But like us, it bears the hallmarks of its creator. And therefore, as Christians, we resist the all-embracing tide of meaninglessness and cynical debasement that surrounds us. In part because we look out and we still see evident signs of the goodness of creation. Where's this? Madeira. Pete and I last Sunday were talking to Nadia, and we were discussing beautiful parts of the world. Nadia is from Madeira, and you can see it's a pretty glorious place, isn't it? We see the glory of creation. And I guess because it was Pete I was talking to, and the subject of beauty came up, we talked about the patchwork beauty of Rwanda, known as Mille Collines. How's your French? Probably not very good with my pronunciation. Mille Collines is a thousand hills. A beautiful language, French, isn't it? Language has beauty, you know. There is beauty in language. There's debasement in language, there is. And cynicism. But language itself is a sign of beauty. A remnant of the beauty of the first creation. Talking of Collines, and it wasn't me who introduced the subject, but Pete. We talked about Skye. That's the Coolin Ridge. Look at that. On the Isle of Skye. No denying the beauty of the earth. That's the Kerrang on the other side of the island. And I'm sure if we were to take some feedback in this room, we could assemble hundreds of beautiful places. Hundreds and hundreds of them across the world. And as John said, we don't have to go very far. Where is that glorious place? Southern Down. It never looks quite that good when I'm there, but maybe Photoshop has helped. But it's a gloriously beautiful place. What about this? Just a little bit further away. Three Cliffs Bay down on the Gower. I mean, we live in a beautiful, beautiful country. My point is that we live among the ruins of goodness. And it's not just natural beauty. You know, humanity is capable of creating beauty. That's York Minster. I've only been there once, but just to stand in that space is to be overawed by a sense of beauty. Lovely to see a cathedral full. Our world, though fallen, displays the unmistakable hallmark of the goodness of God. And not just the physical world. A few weeks ago, Kath and I struggled round the Grehornish Peninsula on the Isle of Skye. If you're ever planning to do that, can I recommend Wellies? Because basically, it's a bog mixed in with marsh on the top of a wetland, right? And as we trudged round it, the showers were just blasting in off the Minch. It was a wild day. And then for about 20 minutes, the rain stopped, and we stopped to eat our rather sodden sandwiches. And we saw the gannets feeding just a few yards from the shore. The sea was rolling black and blue with frosted white tops as the wind whipped it away. That wasn't a picture of the day. It was much windy. And a lot of the gannets were juvenile birds. And they looked like that. They don't have their full glorious plumage. But we were just enthralled. Enthralled at the beauty. It's a gannet diving like an arrow into the sea. Sorry if you weren't quite sure what it was. And I suppose if I was a fish, I might not have appreciated the beauty of the scene. But the unconscious glory of God's creation was certainly visible. And we cannot reduce that, no matter how hard we try. I have a mug, two in fact, in my cupboard. I should have brought one. And it has a picture of my granddaughter laughing on it. And it makes me smile. Every time. You don't need to have a mug. You could go next door, couldn't you? And you would see the laughing, smiling faces of children. Some tears, too, no doubt. You can see mums and dads doubtful at that point. Some tantrums, even. But just the joy. When we finish this, the children will be running around laughing, enjoying themselves. There's beauty in human life. The Bible is rammed full of this stuff. Praise for beauty wherever it is found. The Song of Solomon, for instance, is so articulate on the subjects of beauty that even today, in the cynical world in which we live, we have to choose our readings very carefully because it makes us blush. You have stolen my heart, my sister, my bride. You have stolen my heart with one glance of your eyes, with one jewel of your necklace. How delightful is your love, my sister, my bride. How much more pleasing is your love than wine, and the fragrance of your perfume than any spice. Your lips drop sweetness as the honeycomb, my bride. Milk and honey are under your tongue. The fragrance of your garments is like that of Lebanon. The book is packed with the physical glories of humanity, men and women. Or take care, music. Praise the Lord with the harp. Make music to him on the 10-string lyre. Sing to him a new song. Play skillfully and shout for joy. Play skillfully. Let the Lord not hear Alistair playing the piano. No, we have our music group playing skillfully because it's beautiful. And that beauty in itself is a work of praise. And so while I love, you know, I'm a product of the pop generation, and I can listen to Handbags and Glad Rags all day, but I do look up at the glory of classical music, in part because I believe that in great music we hear a fragment of the glory and the beauty of God. The night sky, pictured here, declares beauty beyond our world, beauty that encompasses the whole of creation. As God says to Job, can you bind the beautiful Pleiades? Can you loose the cords of Orion? Can you bring forth the constellations in their seasons? The heavens declare the glory of God. I'm sure you don't want to listen to me banging on about maths and art and architecture and culture, but we could, couldn't we? Finding beauty in many places, in many, many aspects of the world. Now, if you're struggling with all this beauty and goodness, don't worry. Sin, fall, coming next week. Okay? But why does it matter? Why does it matter? Well, for a very simple reason. The remains of the beauty of our world remind us of God's creative intention. Remind us, indeed, of God. His desire is for a beautiful world. And humanly speaking, a world of justice and fairness and goodness and kindness and peace. I don't know, has anybody read The Magician's Nephew? Yeah, it's a C.S. Lewis book. And I was going to quote it at length this morning, but I thought, no, I'm going to recommend that you read it. And I want you to read it for two things. One, because it's a glorious picture of creation as the great lion Aslan sings the world into being. But secondly, and I've always missed this until I reread it recently, Aslan speaks to the human beings in this new world, and he lists some very simple qualities that he demands of them. And they are mostly around justice and fairness and courage. And those are what are demanded of us by the God who made this world. We are called to take our place in that world, to be better people. Sanctification, we call it, in a Christian context. We are called to work for good and for beauty in this world, even as we look forward to the next. We are called as believers, as followers of Jesus, to live lives that would not be out of place in those first 31 verses of the Bible. I don't know if you subscribe to it, but there's a theory that the first mention of things in the Bible is important. That the first time things are mentioned, we learn something about their definitions. Well, in that case, I can take that theory or leave it. But in that case, the first mention of the world, the first mention of the universe is one of goodness. That God created it very good. And we mustn't forget that. Or if we flip it round and start at the other end, one of the earliest heresies that took hold in the church rejected, and it's quite surprising this until you think about it, they rejected everything physical. Everything. The world was a bad place. Physical bodies were prisons for the spirit. They rejected the whole physical universe as wicked, evil, and utterly broken. And the only right course of action was to abandon the body, either through asceticism, you know, not eating, not drinking very much, you know, avoiding all the pleasures of the world, and looking forward to this escape. The whole of life, spiritual life, was focused on escape. There was no hope for any good things in physical life. In its most extreme form, this heresy said that the physical world was not created by God. It was created by a lesser God. That the proper God only created the spiritual fragments that were lodged inside of people. And therefore, religious faith was all about releasing that spirit back to God. It's like saying the whole creative outpouring of God in the universe was a mistake at best, or an evil work at worst. And the whole thrust of Christianity in that scheme is reduced to this. Sorry, it's a footballing metaphor. Escape to victory. We must let the spirit escape. And everything else is of no value. And crucially, if that's what we believe, there is no duty to strive for a better world now. Because the world can never be better. We can set that completely on one side. These are the words of the risen Jesus. The Christian hope, by contrast, is not an escape from the body, but resurrection of a new body. Resurrection to a glorious new reality. This is what Jesus says. Look at my hands and my feet. It is I myself. Touch me and see. A ghost does not have flesh and bones, as you see I have. Jesus, the firstborn from the dead, enjoys a meal with his followers. Why does he do that? What truth is embedded in that scene? He calls us to follow him with our physical bodies now, those of us who are believers. Not that we look forward to the same old. Our bodies now are all too perishable. And as we get older, we get reminded of that every day. But we will be raised imperishable. God is not yet done with flesh and bones, although what form they take in the resurrection, I don't think we know. By contrast, we've had a look at the past, Christian heresy. We looked at what Christians believe. And what about the world outside our door? Have we ever lived in a more cynical time? Sometimes I wonder why I hate everybody. And then I remember it's probably because of everything. I think that sums up huge aspects of our world. We live in an up-to-date version of escape to victory, except there is no escape and there is no victory. The world is all there is, all there was, and all there will be. And everything in it is without meaning and without purpose. And we must steadfastly, it is our duty, if we are proper rational materialists, it is our duty to resist all attempts to find goodness or beauty or love. They are illusions. And it is our duty to eradicate them. That's why properly secular societies persecute Christians. Because they realize that they are mad or bad. Because they declare a reality beyond the everyday reality that we live in. And if you're a rational materialist, all that is left is the calculation of self-interest. We love our children. That's a reality, isn't it? Ah, yeah, but that's just evolution. You evolve better if you love your children. We love our partners. Oh, well, Marx told us that's an economic calculation. We need to love our partners so we can stick together financially. We're faithful and loyal, or those are just hangovers from a tribal mentality. Best we get rid of those, really. We love music, or that must be social acceptance, or maybe some meaningless genetic quirk. We never, ever in modern life get past this simple dictum: what's in it for me? Our politicians, with our blessing, have reduced politics to what's in it for me. Ideas, ideals are laughable relics of a bygone political age. Our heroes are defined by the money they make and the money they spend. Charity is but a front for publicity or self-esteem. We can debunk everything. What's in it for me? Today I am rendered speechless, as maybe you are too, by a very simple question. In what way does presidential candidate Donald Trump serve as a model for our children? The question is so ridiculous as to be laughable. And the cynic in me, and I'm sorry, yes, there is a cynic in me too, couldn't think of a better icon of our age than him. A man for whom wealth and celebrity and what he can get away with are measures of every worthwhile human attribute. I'm lost for words. Nearly. Vote for me, I'm a very rich man. Is there a more venal approach to politics? It would be funny if it weren't so dangerous and deeply damning of our culture. Worst of all, Christians, oh, I better put them in inverted commas, Christians still line up behind him. Makes you cautious about your definition of what a Christian really means. Who will we hold up as heroes? Trump or Hillary, friend of Wall Street? Premiership footballers seem to be a common... why the media thinks Premiership footballers should be moral paragons in the 21st century, I don't know. I can kick a ball and I can earn a lot of money. Good, well done. Actors, bankers, Britain's Got Talent winners, the presenters of Bake Off. Honestly, I don't know the answer to the question. Where are our heroes? Because our global cynicism works on the basis of grinding everything and everyone down to the lowest common denominator. And it's done a pretty good job. We lose sight of the Creator's hand in our world, and I despair, nearly, for the future. A good bit of advice, you know, that I always take from missionaries: always finish with a sunset. Is that cynical? In fact, I read somewhere, always finish your movie with the couple holding hands and walking off onto the sunset. It adds 10 million, apparently, to the box office. But seriously, our God made a world that was good, very good. And he calls us to strive for goodness. We must love justice, care for the needy, encourage the downhearted, enjoy and celebrate the beauty that still surrounds us. We must declare that despite the brokenness, God sent his Son to save us. That ultimate disaster will not overtake those who declare Jesus Christ is Lord. We must hope and not give up. Hope in a new and better world. We must work and not grow weary. We must, as far as we can, raise our children to believe that their lives are important, that they have meaning, and that they have purpose beyond the brands they wear and the money they earn and the things that they buy. And that ideas and ideals matter. That in our God there is salvation, hope, and peace. What's in it for me? We look forward as believers to the days of a new heaven and a new earth, glorious in their perfection, replacements for our worn out world. A resurrection world where the lion will lie down with the lamb, where there are no more tears and no more sorrow, and where everything is very, very good for a very, very long time.